Welcome to the Human Advisor Podcast. This series is brought to you by Altruist, the first ever fully integrated digital brokerage platform for fiduciary financial advisors. No commissions, no fees, and no biases. The way it should be. Check out humanadvisorpodcast.com for new episodes. Now let's get into today's episode.
Finances to me are, they're human. And we're always human beings making decisions all the time. So behind every single financial transaction, there's a human being that has all sorts of concerns, worries, things going on in their life. And that's pretty much what my practice is about, is like bringing it back to the human, bringing it back to a family system.
All right, welcome back to a special edition of the Human Advisor Podcast. We are literally live on Wall Street. This is really, really neat. I have a special guest for all the reasons we will get into soon. I'm super excited. I'd like to welcome Morgan Rochard to the Human Advisor Podcast of Origin Wealth. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fired up. I can't wait to get into this.
I'm super excited too. Thanks for
having me. Yeah, no, I'm fired up for this for so many reasons that people will get into, but thank you again for having us. It's been a long day for us, and I'm sure, you know, it's been for you as well. The time of year as advisors, as you know, everyone wants to tie things up before year end.
Oh, yeah. And
so, you know, the deal. So lots to cover and so many things we were talking about before we started rolling that I want to cover with you. But
for sure,
let's just start, right? Let's introduce you to the world, to the people out there. Tell us a little bit about you, about Origin, about who you serve and why you serve them.
Yeah, great. So my firm, I started it 5 years ago.
Okay.
So back in 2014, I was working for UBS prior to starting my own firm. And I really liked what I was doing. I just didn't like where I was doing it.
Right. I hear you.
And I think that's kind of the general thing that I hear from the warehouses.
Yeah, I know.
And it's actually kind of, it's a stupid reason to start a business. And I don't suggest that people choose this reason. But basically, I heard of this other person who had a CFA who was starting his own RIA at the time. And I was like, that guy can do it. Like, I could do this, you know? So I just kind of plunged in both feet, got my registration, and then went out on my own in 2014. And because at the time, there weren't really job opportunities for what I wanted. I really wanted to be a portfolio manager. I was really way more focused on the investment stuff than I am now.
Okay.
We can get into what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was all investments, everything. Like, just wanted to be a fee-only investment advisor, thought that that was the right thing to do, thought I was doing my fiduciary duty, and jumped in, started Origin. And about 2 years in, a lady came to my office. She was a really good referral, would have been a great client for me. And she asked me to open a profit sharing plan for her company.
Oh, wow.
And I literally was like, I don't know what that is.
Right.
I was like, that's not covered in the CFA because it's a global exam. So I was like, maybe I should sign up for the CFP. So I literally went home. I obviously did not get this client. Went home, signed up for the CFP. And then honestly, my practice totally changed. So I think like the birth of my firm was definitely 5 years ago, but the birth of my financial planning practice as it is today was 3 years ago.
Wow.
And now I predominantly serve small business owners who generally get paid fairly irregularly. So we deal with a lot of cash flow issues. I also serve busy New York families. And I'm really honestly focusing on families now at this point.
Like,
finances to me are, they're human.
Right.
And we're always human beings making decisions all the time. So behind every single financial transaction, there's a human being that has all sorts of concerns, worries, things going on in their life that is making them either think that they need to make a decision about something or kicking the can down the road.
Right.
And that's pretty much what my practice is about, is like bringing it back to the human, bringing it back to a family system, and just trying to like either help people who are coming from multi-generational wealth or who want to eventually like have their own they're in a position to build multi-generational wealth.
So that's why you're a guest on the Human Advisor Podcast. You said something there that I think a lot of people will be able to glean something from, is having a CFA first and then realizing the value of the CFP, right? And again, we were just talking before we started filming that, right? It says a lot to have both of those designations, right? That's amazing. But talk a little bit about what being a CFP means, right, to your practice, right? And like you said, to go a little bit deeper about how that helped your practice grow and it kind of allowed you to expand your horizons and who you're able to serve and the type of advice you're able to give. Because you can definitely give advice as a CFA, right?
For
but
sure.
It's a particular, you're in this, I don't want to say it's a box, but it's very, very quantitative. It's a particular area, very analytical, but as we were just talking about in a previous conversation, CFP is broad.
Yes,
and you pull
sure.
more people into that. So talk a little bit about how that allowed you to actually grow your practice and what it showed you in working with individuals.
Yeah, so there's the investment piece, and I don't want to minimize the investment piece. And I think a lot of what's gone on in the industry is because, like, we're getting all these robo-advisors, yeah. and there's so much free investment advice out there, and there's all right. these indexes. So we think, oh, we don't need to worry about the investment stuff. That'll just take care of itself. I don't need to pay for that anymore. But I can't tell you how many, like, honestly terrible asset allocations I've seen
in my experience.
Right. So not to minimize the investment piece, but honestly, what happened to me was I needed to go through the CFA curriculum, like, for 3 years, essentially, of, like, grueling stuff to essentially come to the terms with the fact that I think markets are efficient.
Right. Okay.
And that it's not worth me, you know, doing discounted cash flows and all that stuff to, you know, find, you know, companies and stuff like that for my clients.
Right.
That said, though, like, the curriculum doesn't really expand beyond the investment stuff. So there is good stuff in there that will help people learn about investments for sure. It probably takes it to a place that most people don't need to go.
Right.
But the CFP is more broad in what's actually, you know, things that a client cares about.
Right.
So, you know, everything from, like, cash flow planning to retirement planning and across the whole spectrum of things that somebody would actually need in their lifetime is generally in the CFP curriculum. I would argue, though, that the CFP doesn't take it far enough.
So really?
They have their set curriculum. Mm-hmm. They don't really provide any way for a client or basically for an advisor like me to take that curriculum and then go talk to a client.
Okay.
Once you're in the meeting with a client, right, we're human beings.
Right,
and that's
right,
what
right,
this podcast
right,
is all about. We do human being things.
Right.
We don't make rational decisions. We want to do stuff with our money that literally a textbook can't tell us what to do.
Right.
And sometimes what happens is that advisors get so wrapped up in the CFP curriculum or just the numbers in general that they forget that there's a human being that actually has to act on the advice that they're giving.
Right.
And then either what happens is that the person doesn't actually act on the advice because they don't necessarily even agree with the advice, or they end up taking the advice and it's not the right advice for them just because the numbers said that they should do that. So
right.
what I've found is that it's a combination of, for sure, applying the curriculum, but also listening to a human being, having a
right.
conversation like we're having right now that's very open-ended, where the client can discuss what they want to discuss
right.
instead of me coming in with my agenda. And that, like, really means, though, that I'm checking my biases at the door as much as possible, which is obviously very difficult for people to do because we come with all sorts of experiences and backgrounds that we
yeah.
want to just shove onto our client
right,
that comes
right,
through
right,
the door.
Right.
But where I'm not them, right? They know their life. They're the expert in their life. They're telling me what they want. And I really need to listen to that and then apply the advice and not the other way around. So if that means that maybe they pay a little bit more in taxes or maybe the numbers aren't exactly the way that the CFP textbook would tell me to do it,
right.
it's going to be better for them because they'll actually be able to follow that advice and then they'll have better results in
right.
the long term.
Yeah. I believe that anyone who's looking for financial advice should start with a CFP,
for
right?
Sure.
There are CFPs who are terrible, right? I deny that, right? There's all CFPs aren't great. And then there are financial advisors, right? I don't have the CFP designation that have a specialization that are worthy in the area of expertise, and we'll get into crypto. But I think in the future that will be the standard. And it's not too far along in the future that every advisor will be a CFP. What do you say to that? Do you think so? And do you think it would make sense for, piggybacking on what you said, for as the value of investment, right, management goes down, financial planning goes down, do you think it would make, one, sense for the CFP to broaden it so it's more behavioral finance in there and more, what are they calling it now, soft skills, right?
Yeah.
And then say, all right, we've broadened the curriculum, and then now that if you want to be a financial advisor, this is it. Because when you look at it, right, you have MDs, you have JDs,
yeah.
you have, right? I feel like we need that standard.
For sure. I totally agree. I think that my hope is that that's where the industry goes and
right.
that people who deal with individuals or families or even small businesses and they're helping in a financial planning capacity that they have a CFP for sure. I would love that to be the standard. I think, though, it's not going to be enough ultimately. Like, where people are going to end up getting either other designations or they're going to specialize. So it'll be like this, and it's kind of the way you were talking about with doctors and everything
yeah.
else, right? Like, they get their MD, right? But then they go and they do a residency and they specialize in something specific.
Right.
That seems to be what's happening in the financial advisory space as well, because it's a lot easier to specialize in something and learn a lot about that one specific thing and actually be able to help people
right.
than it is to be more of a generalist in A, it's hard for you to market to clients, right? Because you don't really know who you're marketing to.
Right.
B, you're spending a lot more time trying to figure figure out what you need to do for these people because it's not really your niche, quote unquote. And then C, maybe you're not even giving the right advice because if you haven't seen it before, maybe there's something that you're missing. So I think it does help. So in that regard, either you'll I think you'll probably see people have dual designations going for other things. Or that they'll just be, you know, a specialist in that one specific thing and market themselves as that.
No, I definitely think that's the way to go in explaining to people, because there's so much education that has to be continued to be explained to people about what a fiduciary is. We throw that out there and just like, you know, we hide behind it. It's what does that actually mean? Right? And it's like, okay, well, CFPs are fiduciaries. And if I work in an RIA, I'm a fiduciary, but an advisor that's not a CFP that works in an IRA. So people are kind of like, whatever, right?
So that's
why I feel like there has to be a standard there. And it's cool that you, again, after having the CFA, getting the CFP, explaining all that, I think that's really cool for any young advisor to look at that and understand the value prop in that. And it helps me in my argument as well on Twitter. So thank you.
For sure. And then I'd like to add something to that if I can. So
sure.
I'm actually going for my registered life planner designation as part of the Kinder Institute.
Awesome.
And if anyone wants to expand their soft skills, I mean, that's one of the best places to start.
Yeah. And
I found that I've just significantly improved how I'm having conversations with clients, and I haven't even gone through the whole thing yet. So.
Right.
I'm really excited about that because that's definitely taking my practice in the direction that I already foresee it going, and it's just going to deepen relationships and make it easier for me to, you know, have these kinds of conversations.
We've been blessed and fortunate enough to have Scott Frank on, who embodies that to the T, and I definitely think, again, something like that as well, as you mentioned, dual, right?
Yep.
Dual designations, certifications, whatever it may be. And I think as an industry, going to have to be retrained because of how technology is continuing to decimate our business, and it is going to be on you to demonstrate that you can be an active listener, that you can really tap into people's emotions, that you yourself could be vulnerable, right? Like, that's literally how I built my practice, like literally just showing people my vulnerabilities and speaking passionately about things that I care about and that I'm from, right? So people gravitate to that. And then you're also able to expose people to things that are just in their blind spot. So that's awesome. But I definitely want to now, right? We went into a little bit into your practice, but a little bit about you, where you grew up, where you're from. Let's hear more about you.
Sure, I grew up in Rockaway in Queens.
Okay.
My parents are still out there. It's a little beach community. It's a peninsula part of Queens.
Shout out to Queens.
Yeah. My parents, they're still together. They've been married for how many years now? I think it's 40 years in 2020.
Wow, that's
awesome.
Yeah,
they'll be married for 40 years.
Okay.
My sister lives out in Seattle now.
Okay.
And I have two nieces who are out there.
Awesome.
I have a almost two-year-old son.
Okay, awesome.
And yeah, my husband and I live in Brooklyn now, but we're moving to Austin in January.
Awesome.
Growing up, honestly, I had a really, I had a charmed childhood.
You did? Awesome.
I really did.
Okay.
My parents, they gave us everything that they could. They really did. We went to great schools. I think they gave us so much that we didn't learn very much about money.
Right. What is your first memory of money? That was my next question. What is your, as you remember, your first interaction with money, or what is the first experience that you have where you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So I was a kind of a compulsive counter growing
really?
Up. Yeah. So I had this number line. I went to a Montessori school when I was a really young kid.
Okay.
And they had these number lines, and most kids, you know, they went up to 50 or 60, but I took it to 799, an outrageous number. Yeah. And my mom still has this number line in the house. So I was everywhere, just always counting and reading numbers and counting. So you can see why I ended up going for my CFA.
Right.
And
we're
in the store, the grocery store one time, and I looked at one of the numbers on there, and I was like, that apple costs $299 or something. I said something like that.
Right.
And my mom was like, no, there's a decimal. It's 2.99.
Right.
And I didn't understand. So she was trying to explain to me fractional dollars, basically.
Right.
So that's definitely my first experience with money. My parents were very, they were open about how they saw money work. But as far as us, we never had an allowance. We always just asked for money.
Really?
We didn't really touch money in any way.
Right.
I don't until I had my first job, which was in college.
Wow.
I was always told studying is your job, not working. So
right.
I think honestly, it was a huge shock for me when I got my first job and I got my first paycheck, and I was like, oh, like
Who's FICA?
Yes, exactly. I have all these expenses. Right, like, what
right,
is this?
Right, I had no idea. Who's the Social Security person?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah, and honestly, I was very irresponsible with money as a right. result of that, and I really had to change that around.
Right.
I had to do a lot to, like, learn this stuff on my own. I would ask questions, but, like, my parents didn't really, I mean, they're great people. They're, I love them to death, but they didn't really have the answers that I needed.
Right.
And I was actually pre-med in college. I thought I was going to be a doctor.
Wow.
Volunteered for it at a hospital. Didn't really like sick people. So I dropped that, and I graduated, you know, with a health science degree.
Okay.
And
from
Boston University.
Okay.
And
okay.
then went and got my first job working on the floor of the Amex. I started, like, getting coffee, basically, for a bunch of guys who were trading equity options.
Right.
And they, like, I memorized the coffee order, and they liked me.
Right.
And they were like, all right, well, if you pass the Series 7, like, we'll give you a job here. So,
Series 7
yeah.
for you was like...
exactly. I was like, okay, no problem. So I took that in a few weeks or whatever.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
they offered me a job. So I did that for the first 2 years before I started working for a couple of different wirehouses. So
wow.
that's kind of how I got where I am today. But in the meantime, I had to, like, learn all this stuff about personal finance and figure out how to save and where to put it and all this stuff. And I was getting advice, honestly, from people who they didn't know either.
Right.
So, I don't know.
I think, no, that's perfect. And I think this is, I love this moment that's about to happen right now, because my childhood couldn't be any more different from yours. But the same result in that I wasn't taught about money.
Yeah.
We didn't have any to teach, but... I always get people to, always want people to understand, if you grew up with a very cushy childhood where you didn't have to worry about money, I wish I would have switched with you in an instant. But there is still an issue where 90%+, right, of wealth is lost in this country after, I think, the second or third generation.
Yeah.
So all across the spectrum, there's financial literacy
sure.
and there's lack of financial education. And it could sometimes be even worse in this sense if you, right, if the parents prepare the path for the child and not prepare the child for the path. So now, right?
It's a fair point.
Right? I'm on this path, and now I get a job and I don't know anything, right?
Exactly.
And now I have to try and do all of these things myself, right? Where I feel like if you were born with a PhD like I was, right, poor, hungry, and driven, you kind of learn the hard things along the way, right? You just
yeah.
figure out. So it's like, okay, well, there's $5 for now until when? Like, we got to stretch this money. So the lessons are embedded through the struggle, where if you're protected from that, you kind of find out on your own as an adult, as opposed to as a kid, where it's like, okay, you guys are telling me no, because if I did get what I wanted, we wouldn't have lights,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Or we wouldn't eat, right? Or we wouldn't have a roof over our head. So I think that is, there's beauty in that statement, because I want everybody to understand, again, this is not an issue where financial literacy or financial education is just for, you know, this particular group of people that, you know, don't have access to financial advisors. It's everybody.
It's so true.
Right? And that is a crisis in this country. And it is incumbent upon us. Again, you want to talk about true diversity, get away from color, but diversity of background.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? Of how we grew up, and bringing that to a conversation where you can get people from all stripes, all denominations, all the areas of the country in a room that are financial advisors and go, yeah, my parents didn't teach me about money either. How'd you find out? Right? Like, we're not too far from the stock exchange. I literally walked right by it. Like, what is all this fuss about? Right? Like, that's
sure.
dangerous, right?
And honestly, I'd take it even further. I mean, I have clients who come in, they have trusts that were given to them. So they're way more well off than I grew up, and obviously you too.
Yeah.
And they're given these trusts, and these trust documents, they have all sorts of stipulations in them about when they can touch the money and how much they can take out and all of these things. And they are so disconnected from their money as a result of it. And I know, like, we go, oh, boo-hoo, poor trust fund kid. But at the same time, they actually experience quite a lot of, like, mental health issues because
of course.
It.
So I have a really crazy story about that. So I was up in Boston meeting with a very large RIA, and I'm actually having a conversation with a financial advisor, and he has to stop the meeting because someone was coming in, right, the heiress of the Merck family, $1 billion
yeah.
of stock certificates, right? Like, and she was freaking out. Like, could you imagine? Now, what do you want me, like, I'm in charge of all of this now. Like, what do you want me to do? So again, I think there's anxiety on every side of it.
For sure.
I would much rather have that type of stress, as I think a lot of people would.
Yeah, I hear you, but for sure.
Along the way, I think there needs to be, we need to put the focus again on financial literacy, right? And I talk about on Twitter taking financial literacy literally, that there are people really don't know what a maiden name is when I look at this form. My parents don't really get the whole debit credit thing in the statement. I actually still have to walk them through that. And then also the financial education piece for those that may have a little more than others, but are just in the dark, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Saving, trying, what is a 401k? You know, and I know you get this a lot. People get their 401k and it's like, well, what are these thousand of options that I have, right?
For sure.
Is an EMA? Like, they have no idea. So all across the board, we have a tremendous responsibility to continue to educate people. So thanks for bringing that up and sharing that. That's really important. So let's move into the business, right?
Okay.
And the state of the business and the state of the industry. Right now, there's so much going on, right? With fees going to zero, and they say robo advisors, and you have crypto and this whole thing. Like, what now as you start to, again, your practice, you said it's 5 years old?
Yep, 5 years old.
Yeah, as obviously you're still growing and expanding. Like, what are some of the challenges that you're facing now in growing your practice, if any? It may be going well. But is there any challenges that you face as our industry literally changes by the day?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say I was definitely more resource strapped when I started, right? Because like I saved what I thought was a good amount to go start a business.
Right.
And I was like, maybe I need to move in with my parents and do anything I can to like keep this thing going.
Right.
And then by year three, I really started to hit my stride and I started to be more time strapped than resource strapped. And then we had our son in 2018. So my business was a little over 3 years old. And I was just like, I went from being time strapped to being just ridiculously time strapped.
Okay.
So one of the big initiatives that I had for 2019 was hiring staff and bringing people in to help.
Okay.
And so far that's going well. I have a part-time assistant who helps me, and I have a part-time paraplanner who's also just been amazing.
Cool.
I'm probably going to bring him on full-time for next year, which would be really, really great.
Awesome.
And so, I mean, that's kind of the challenge that I'm hitting now is like, does what's going on in my business really align with my life's goals?
Right.
Because I also want to spend time with my son. We want to have more kids.
Yeah.
Right now I try to spend as much time with them as I can, but what ends up happening is that I have two designated days to work, and then I'm answering emails between nap times and after hours and doing all this stuff. So I'm like fitting in a 40-hour work week into like 2 days plus, which isn't ideal.
Right. No, not at all.
For sure. But, you know, like clients have stuff that they need to happen and get done. So I guess I'm just like right now the difficulties that I'm coming up with is like, where do I want to take my practice really? Do I want to grow it and make it be something really big, or do I want to like keep it as a lifestyle practice, which is obvious it's where I'm leaning,
right?
And kind of like take my time growing and then wait until my kids are basically in school to like make Origin be what it kind of always visioned it would be,
right?
So it's really just a balancing act, I think, for me right now.
And that's the thing, is like sometimes the challenge in this business is just managing your personal life along with a profession that I think it really underestimated how demanding it is, right? Like this job requires a lot of you. And again, we do have the flexibility to take care of family and take days off or whatever. So we are abundantly privileged in that regard, but it's you can't turn it off. Right?
No, for sure not. And then it's also just making sure. So like I now think of myself as kind of a scarce resource to the world because I have a nice size practice. It really wouldn't be the end of the world if I didn't get another new client for quite a long time.
Wow.
So it's like a nice place to be in for sure.
That's awesome.
I also do like to do like the happy dance of getting a new client.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, of course.
And I like helping new people and I like the challenge of, you know, looking at somebody's finances and trying to figure out and help them and all that stuff.
Right.
But on the same level, like there's my son, I want to be there for him, I want to watch him grow up, I don't want to miss anything.
Yeah.
If I want to have more kids too, like how do I make all of that work? And like when I really vision the way that I see my life, at least for the next 5 years, like it's being there for my family.
Right.
And it's something that I share with clients as well, and where my clients, my practice is really evolving towards, I guess, and this kind of happens to all advisors, their practices start to look like them after a while.
100%.
As my mentor
said a long time ago, he's like, your practice is going to start to look a lot like you.
For sure. Yeah, so it's really like that family at the core.
That's awesome.
And that's generally who I'm attracting now, are people who like busy New Yorkers, kind of like me.
Right.
Who, you know, they care about their family and they want to do the right thing for their family, and they're kind of putting family first.
Right.
So along with that comes with a bunch of other probably continuing education that I'm going to do around family systems and helping families in that regard.
That's awesome.
But it's really kind of setting the stage for how they can eventually, you know, impart all of the knowledge that they're learning onto the next generation. So it's kind of like a literacy effect
yes.
as well.
Yeah, so, we're going to get to that.
Talking to clients about how they can talk to their children about yep. some of these things and yep. sharing advice about how they can look at, like, giving an allowance and, like, mm-hmm. how to handle that and all the things that come with that. That's stuff that actually comes up in my practice as well. So it's not just like, hey, here's your asset allocation and here's your five to-dos.
Right.
It's like, let's have a conversation about where you want to take this in right. your life and what you see your family doing.
I hate to do this because I always tell people, we're going to have this broad conversation and talk about you, but I bring this up for this reason, tax planning, right? Mm-hmm. How do you handle that, especially for families? Because I got a question from friend/client about, you know, kids and tax time and that whole thing. And shout out to Jeff Levine, CPA planner. And I asked him, and he just sent me this long, again, another brilliant individual.
Yeah, Jeff probably knows better
than me. He is out of his mind brilliant.
Yeah.
And he sent me this, you know, long, detailed answer in DM that I was able to share with the client. But also, my niece has two young sons. So I have two great nephews. Mm. And I was able to share that advice with her. And then we were talking again behind the scenes. And he goes, no one's doing this for people that are starting families. Like, this is such valuable information,
yeah.
right, about, you know, the tax savings and all of those things, the nuance of, well, if you do this much and where you live, New York versus whatever. So, mm-hmm. you know, how do you handle tax planning? Is that something that comes up, or you outsource that, or?
So I do tax planning in-house.
You do?
I typically
okay.
try to work with whoever the CPA is that the client already is working with, unless yeah. they don't like their CPA, and then
right.
we find somebody else. But yeah, we do projections for sure, and we look at it. But it always comes back to the human, like,
right.
and we kind of touched on this at the beginning
yeah.
of the podcast. But it's like, what's the purpose of the money? What are we trying to accomplish here? Like, generally, when people come into my office and they're worried about taxes, there's usually something else behind that
yep.
that's not being addressed.
Yep.
That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do the tax planning, for sure.
Right,
but
right.
I always try to address that other concern because, like, everything always comes back to the human being and what's going on. And it's a little hard for me. I know it's kind of a vague answer to your question.
No, it's not. You're hitting on it. Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Hard to address that without addressing the other concern behind there, because if I just handed a tax plan across the desk, then, like, yeah, sure, they can follow it. But it's not really going to address the main concern that they have if we don't hit on it. So it goes back to, like, listening to your client and
yeah.
being there for them and being empathetic to their needs. Because, like, whatever it is that is on their mind, even if it seems, you know, like, nothing to us or trivial because, we know the tax planning numbers. It's not to them.
Right.
And there's a reason why they're coming and asking this question. So
right.
I always take it there first.
Yeah. Russell Kroger as well, a previous guest, shout out to Russell. He does tax planning in-house. And I'm starting to see more advisors integrate that into their practice and what it, like, again, just a value add, right? Again, with data from the client and listening and doing all that. But again, as our business continues to be decoupled and pulled apart, that value add of bringing that into your practice is going to be huge. So I don't want to spend too much time on that. But
yeah,
when you mentioned
sure.
it, I think for those that are young and starting families, I think it's just super valuable. And no one really talks about that.
Yeah, right? For sure. And then, like, I mean, I don't do tax returns or anything, but it does
yeah.
help. Because, like, a lot of the stuff that you do for, like, can do for your taxes has to take place during the calendar year. It's
yep.
not when you, like, you call your CPA in February, it's done. You
yeah.
can't, like, with the exception of putting some money into an IRA if you're
yeah.
eligible.
Like, yeah, right,
you kind of,
right.
like, miss the boat here.
Right,
so.
Right. Absolutely. Shout out to all CPAs. We appreciate
yep.
you. So what about tech? How does, well, actually, let me, before we go there, mm-hmm. what about marketing? How do you market, you know?
I do this.
Yeah, really?
Yeah,
the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have my own podcast.
Okay.
I also have my second business, which is Money Owners, which we can get into.
Yeah.
And that's my financial coaching practice.
Do it. Let's talk about it.
Honestly, I do more marketing for that. I don't really do any marketing for Origin. For the most part, it's word of mouth, it's referrals, is majority of where I get my clients. I'm part of XY Planning Network. I've gotten a few clients from there as well.
Right.
With the exception of that, I mean, I don't do a whole lot. I have an infographic I put out once a month, and I post it on Twitter and LinkedIn, so sometimes I get something from that.
Right.
But that's basically it.
Right.
But it's been kind of nice. I mean, I'm not looking to have this gigantic client base. I'm only really looking to have 30 to 35 clients at any given time anyways. So I don't need to do huge amounts of marketing for that. Money owners is a little bit different. So because it's financial coaching, they're small, short engagements. It used to be a different engagement prior to me going for my life planning designation. It was more of an open-ended coaching program. Now it's really just going through the Evoke process, but leaving off the K and the E. So Evoke is exploration, vision, and obstacles.
I love that.
And then K and E is knowledge and then execution.
Okay.
Knowledge and execution falls under financial planning. So if a client wants that, they have to go to Origin, basically. But if they just want to go through the first three parts of it and really get a good like handle on where they want to go in their life, then that's what I'm offering there.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Now, is that something that can be... So is that anyone? Like, can you take that into schools or?
Honestly, anyone can do that. Generally, so my podcast, Money Owners, has been mostly like geared towards small business owners, just because that's typically who I deal with, and also families, because that's also who I deal with. So I can pretty much, I talk to myself for a half hour, so
you
can imagine I can be terribly long-winded, but I've gotten really comfortable at like literally staring at a wall and just having a conversation with myself. So in regards to that, like it's stuff that I know.
Right.
So it tends to be for families and small business owners. So that's who I've gotten in Money Owners so far, is either people who are like, they're in a corporate job looking to start their own business. They need some help along the way. Or just like a busy family came in and they were like, oh, everything's all over the place. Let's do this.
Right.
But I honestly, I can help anyone like that. Right. But I don't like to market that way.
Right.
So what was the genesis of that? You just saw the need in the market, or you just were like, let me try this?
So what was happening was that people were coming into my financial planning practice wanting financial planning. And I was like, but you don't need planning. You just need like a little coaching to go on your way. You don't really have any assets to invest. Like, why are you like, you don't need to be in a whole RIA setting where like we're pitching you a bunch of investment advice.
Right.
You could just be over here in this unregulated area where it'll be really easy for me to give you advice. It'll be really easy for you. We don't have to go through this whole song and dance with like FINRA, basically.
Right.
I can offer it to you, and it's less of a cost to me, so I can offer it to you at a lower cost as well.
Right.
And the thing that's really nice about that is I don't have to keep the compliance records the way I do for my financial planning firm.
Yeah.
And all of that, it takes a lot of time. It takes effort. There's money involved with that. So all of that, unfortunately, gets passed on to my clients. And obviously me as well, because I take home less as a result. But people who go through Money Owners, they don't have to, like, there's none of that. So I can offer basically this nice service at a cheaper price.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome. And my brain is racing now, because I think that is a framework that all financial advisors could use. Because the whole thing is, right, you look at what Altruist is trying to do is make it cheaper and more efficient for financial advisors to run their practice, because the whole thing in this business is, I got to go find someone with $100 million, and then I got to find, right? And then you only going, it forces you to go after a certain segment, which now you're cutting off all of your valuable advice from middle class people and people who need it. So I think something like that, that might be a paradigm shift for our business, where advisors feel like, okay, well, maybe this is a scaled down version of planning, right? You may not need planning, you just need basic. And it's funny, this leads me into what we were talking about before with crypto and my clients. I'm like, well, it's just kind of like consulting at this point, just telling you that this makes sense, this doesn't. The planning part comes way later, right? Like, you're not there yet. So I think that's a really neat idea, I think, for as financial advisors reach out to me and say, well, hey, how do I open up myself to be able to give more to other people, and then do it at a price point, right, that makes sense to them, you know?
And that makes sense for the advisor too, right? We're like, we have a lot of expertise. We tend to sell ourselves short, I think, especially like the ones that I know who have gone independent, who are part of XY Planning Network, pricing way too low. And they're doing it because they want to serve a certain segment of the market that might not even need planning.
Right.
So it's something really to consider if you're one of these advisors who is, you're charging $100 or $150 a month to clients, but maybe they don't actually need financial planning.
Right.
Like maybe they need some help with their student loans, which doesn't fall under a registered investment advisor, and you help them with some of that, and then you help them with some coaching, and you send them on their way, and now, like, you don't have any of the burden of being part of a registered investment advisor, so you could service this client.
Right.
Like, maybe you still can service them at $150 a month, but you don't have all the overhead and other things that go on. So it's just something to think about for advisors. Like, if that's really the market that they want to be serving, then maybe, like, you don't even need to have an RIA to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So this is the first moment on the podcast that we're going to do this, because you are familiar with crypto and you integrate crypto into your practice.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about
sure.
that. So again, everyone knows that I've literally built a practice around that, and that's kind of where I've hung my hat, right, and hung my shingle out, like Tyrone Ross, the crypto advisor. But talk a little bit about how you integrate crypto into your practice, and we'll get, you know, we'll drop the dime on why I'm still sitting here bugging out in a minute. But talk a little bit about that, like how do you handle it when clients come to you, or are you transacting for clients? Are you just giving them advice? Like, what does that look like if someone comes to
for
you
sure.
with an interest in crypto?
So usually what happens is that a client comes in and they probably already bought it.
100%.
In the case. 100%. So, and whatever they bought is probably not what they were supposed to be buying.
100%.
And then if that's the case, then it's a completely different conversation. But let's assume that that's not who we're dealing with, right? Sometimes a client comes into my office and they say, I want to buy gold.
Uh-huh.
And I hear this, actually, I heard this a lot this year specifically because everything going on with the Fed, Trump wanted to lower interest rates, put pressure on the Fed. They ended up lowering interest rates. Clients freaked out. They're like, what does this mean for inflation? You know, all the same concerns that happened in 2008 about interest rates being lowered and, you know, tips going through the roof and all that stuff came back up again this year. And I heard it from a lot of clients that they wanted to hold gold. When that kind of opens the door for me to be like, hey, if you're already thinking about this other alternative asset class that we typically don't include in portfolios, what do you think about potentially including Bitcoin in your portfolio? And then we discuss whether or not it makes sense for them personally to do it.
Oh, wow.
So that's how I've opened the door for clients who wasn't on their mind.
Okay.
Other clients, though, then I have another subsection of my client population who just asked. Like, you know, I saw this in the news, like, what do I need to know about it? And then, obviously, I'm really open and have a discussion about, like, what I think is going on in the space. I am biased, for sure. We can get into why.
Yes, we will.
But I tend to be Bitcoin only.
Bitcoin only.
I do think that a lot of these other currencies have issues, and a lot of them are scams.
Right.
My number one thing as a fiduciary duty to my client is to absolutely make sure that you do not invest any money into what I believe to be a scam.
Right.
So for the most part, I steer my clients away from 95% of the crypto assets out there.
Right. So I love this. So now, when you do, and I love the fact that you say you've actually gone out and said, hey, if you're thinking about gold, Bitcoin, that is interesting because even I don't do that. Like, my clients already own it. They're like, I have this portfolio of Bitcoin and all this other stuff, right? And what do you think? And I'm like, I think that looks terrible, but whatever. You know, you did it.
And not a hard sell, obviously. Think about it, maybe read the couple articles, and then you let
me know.
So
what is the next step if they say, okay, do you then have a way that you go and actually transact on behalf of them?
I direct them one place or another. I would say probably the majority of my clients use Coinbase just because it's easy.
Yep.
I'd love for there to be another option out there.
Right.
I'd love there to be an option where my client can literally do it, and their only option to buy is like Bitcoin or another very large name out there.
Right.
That they're not like being tempted by all of the, you know, currencies that are worth 0.01,
right.
You know, and that they think could go to 20,000. That's like my nightmare, is really like when a client gets on Coinbase and they're like looking at all the other things that they could buy.
Yeah.
And you're like,
what a basic attention token.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, just buy that one.
Right.
You know,
right.
Stop looking at this. So, and then the question is also like, should clients keep their assets at Coinbase?
Right.
My general thought is no. But that being said, like, I also don't want a client to like lose their private keys. So, like, it would be great if there was a brokerage service out there where like I would feel comfortable a client would be actually holding crypto assets at. And I mean, no knock on Coinbase. They've been around for a long time. I don't know what's going on under the hood at Coinbase.
Right. Right,
they're
right,
a startup
right.
that got funding. Like, and for all I know, like, they could go belly up, and you know, it's basically a Bitcoin receivable, right?
Right.
So you don't own your private keys, you don't own your coins.
Yep.
But I also don't want my clients to have their private keys and then they lose it. So
absolutely.
There's an opening there for sure.
I'm working on something.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Okay. Maybe
That's
you
awesome.
Have the answer. I'm sure you're seeing the same thing that I'm seeing.
No, I'm seeing the exact same thing.
And I've had this conversation with a lot of clients over and over again because it's like, okay, well, I'd love for you to move your coins out, and they're like, okay, but I'm gonna lose them.
It's too hard right now. And if the client isn't tech savvy, right, and which is why the conversations that I have with clients, one is, again, shout out to Jeff Levine, it's a digital fiduciary, right, and understanding, right? You may understand all of the public, private key, all this other stuff. Does your next of kin, does your family, does anyone else know this besides you? And if something happens, right, and you have this large position in Bitcoin and you bump your head and you just happen to pass away, like, what good is that to your family if they don't understand it?
Or if they don't even know you have it and they throw it out?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So there's, and I think that's one thing that is not addressed enough in this space is, again, estate planning around crypto.
Yeah, for sure.
It is such an area that is ripe for attention, not even disruption, because there's nothing going on there. So
I think that's going to come about in the next 10 years or so.
100%. Sure. Yeah. Sooner or later. And I think you're starting to see more of it now. People starting to pay attention to it. And there's some really notable crypto names and critter on Twitter who are literally saying, you're right, I don't have estate planning for this. I just have all this, you know. So I'm like, what are you guys doing?
There is an estate attorney out there, though. I don't know if you know Jeff Andrew.
Jeff Andrew, yep. And there's a woman who wrote a really good book, Pamela. Can't think of her last name now. She wrote a book. But I keep shouting her out anyway. She never says thank you, so whatever. But she wrote a really good book on it as well. So now that we're name dropping, I mean, we just gotta, I mean, this is amazing.
Keep name dropping.
Yeah, keep name dropping. There's something, name that you should drop. So again, everyone knows that I am crypto Twitter through and through. So before we're filming, Morgan, share with me who her husband is. So tell the people.
My husband is Pierre Rochard. And he is a Twitter celebrity.
Yeah. So if you know anything about crypto with Twitter and just crypto, like Pierre Rochard is it. I could not believe when she said that. So Pierre, shout out to you, man. And I'm blessed to have his follow. So that I take that very seriously. But that is so awesome. And I think obviously that gives you a leg up in terms of your crypto knowledge.
Yeah, for sure. So I think I've learned so much by just like osmosis, literally like sitting there and half the honestly, I mean, we've been together 7 years now. So like half the and he's been spouting like Bitcoin stuff since we met. So like literally our first date was like him talking about Bitcoin.
Right.
So like at the beginning I was like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, but I'm just gonna listen. Right. And then sometimes I was like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about and I'm gonna tune this out.
Right.
And then I even from tuning it out though, but I would hear like the same stuff quite a bit. And I would hear about his databases and the other stuff that he was working on. And I was just like, and he's way more versed in Austrian economics than I am. I read a couple of books when I was in college, but he's the master. I just read a couple of things. But I hear like the stuff that he's saying and I'm like, oh, well that actually, you know, that's
kind
not that crazy.
Sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the way you're saying it is a little crazy.
Right.
But like the underlying part of it is not.
Right.
And then, you know, over time I sort of evolved my own thoughts about Bitcoin and where it was going and like the potential it really could have in my client's portfolio. And honestly, like when I talk to clients about it, it's an insurance policy. It is possible that everything that the Bitcoin maximalists and other people in the crypto space are talking about actually happens, right? That like this currency displaces the dollar. And then all of my clients who did their best to save all their dollar assets end up in some hot water, right?
Yep.
I don't think it would be so much of an issue for stocks, but it is potentially an issue for bondholders, right? And redenomination, it's not so simple with bonds. So it does then make sense to have like, you know, 1-5% of your net worth just sitting there and, you know, just buy it and don't think about it and don't look at the price. And, you know, think of it as like, okay, I'm holding this because maybe in 30 years, like the whole world looks different and we're flying around in cars and everything's Jetsons, right?
Right.
So, you know, what's the big deal if it's money that you don't really need?
Right.
Right.
So before we get off this topic, and it's not coming from me because I'm biased and everyone knows, right? If there's any financial advisor out there that are a little nervous about this or, you know, like, oh, you know, dismissing it because they're all getting it from clients, they're asking, right, what advice would you give besides following your husband?
That's a good start for sure.
What advice would you give them?
So it's difficult to sift through what is good and what is not good information. So it is actually important to follow the right people on Twitter.
Right.
It does seem like the majority of the conversations do happen there. And then also on Medium, there are a lot
100%
of good posts.
Reddit,
And then I think, like, I mean, I wish I had better advice, but I really do think it does make sense to at least start, like, by trying to follow a few people that are really big in the Bitcoin space.
Right.
People working at Chain Code Labs, like, they're talking about what's going on with the code, at least. That might be way over people's heads, but at least from there, you can kind of see who they're following and then go from there and read everybody's Twitters. I think the other problem is, like, there's a lot of things that have been tokenized, right, out there. And they have very loud mouths, and they're lobbying, and they're doing all sorts of things, and maybe I'm, like, going off into a place where I don't even know as much about this
as you probably do.
But because of it, there's a lot of misinformation, and a lot of the stuff that's being reported by journalists isn't necessarily something that is helping the advisor community. But unfortunately, that's where we typically get our information about that stuff. So I think advisors need to be a lot more open about how they're getting information on this, as opposed to, you know, going to the general news sources.
Yes, it's bad advice. Yeah, I agree. That's free jewelry. Yes, absolutely.
I have a study group that I meet with every 3 weeks, and they're, like, awesome, tip-top guys. You should interview both of them when you have a chance.
Yeah, but absolutely.
This came up. And, like, he was asking me about Ethereum, and I was telling him, like, why potentially there could be issues with Ethereum. And he was like, well, this is not anything that's ever come up. Like, how would I have come across this information? And it's like, okay, well, I kind of have it easy, right?
I
just go home and I hear about this, and then I, like, sort of remember it, and then I hear about it again, and then then it's, like, solidified in there. So, yeah, but it's, like, definitely, like, even very smart people who were super competent, who, like, I would totally trust. But, I mean, these two guys, like, if I died, like, I hope my husband would go to them and ask financial advice.
Right.
They're getting misinformation because there's really bad information out there. So, for sure, it's a problem.
Incredible. This is so awesome. This is so awesome. So to put a bow tie on the end of this conversation, when again, talking about the state of the industry, I'm a black man, you're a woman in this business. We are a minority, right? What has that been like for you? Especially like you said, you were a gopher at first. They're sending you for coffee, and you were probably smarter than everybody in the damn room, right? Or on the floor.
I don't know. They were pretty smart guys.
Yeah,
they were clowns,
you probably
though.
Were. They're clowns. It's okay. Well, I'll say it for you. But what has that experience been like for you? And the other thing is, if there is a young Morgan out there watching this, right? What advice would you give yourself, and what would you give her?
Yeah.
If she's interested in following in your footsteps and being you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to fit in. That was the number one thing. I wanted to be in the industry. I wanted to fit in. So I just did whatever I had to do to fit in.
Okay.
I don't know necessarily if that's how you do it now.
I think
if I were getting out of college now and I got the same job, which doesn't even exist anymore, but if that were available to me, I don't think it would be the way that it was back then. So this is 11 years ago now that I started out.
Wow.
So I cut my hair short, which was, like, it's a big deal for me. I'm, like, pretty attached to my long hair.
Right.
And I, you know, I shouted with them in a pit because I thought that was what I was supposed to do. And I was aggressive because I thought that that's how I was supposed to act.
Wow.
But that's not really who I am. And it, even to the point where I changed who I was and I believed that that was who I was.
Right.
So all I wanted to do was be a trader after I did that for a couple of years because I'd become that. And I thought that was who I was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until I transitioned out of that and started working in wealth management and started working in a proper office where you wear proper clothing and you converse with people in low tones. You don't yell.
Yeah, exactly.
And you don't like
kick
things down in the bathroom when things don't go your way. Like, I remember one of the guys I worked for, like, an order didn't go his way, and he literally picked up his stool and he threw it into the escalator, and he shattered the glass on the side of it. And then we all basically worked in the glass for, like, another few hours until they were able to get somebody to come and clean it up. So, but that was normal to me. I thought that's just, like, what people did in offices. Because, I mean, also getting back to our beginning of our conversation, I never held really a job. Like, I was a lifeguard. I did some babysitting. I never did anything real until I graduated from college. So I had no, like, way of comparing that to what, you know, another real job could potentially be until I got to Merrill Lynch. And then I was like, oh, like, you gotta wear a suit every day and you have to, like, be nice to people. And you don't, like, keep CNBC, like, blasting at the top of the, and so I went through that experience for sure. The person I worked for, she was a tough cookie.
Right.
I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah.
But she was tough, and she was very tough on me, and she said a lot of really not so great things to me. And I ended up switching teams when I was at Merrill Lynch to a smaller team, and we had all African clients, and I was doing a lot of like really cool, actually, forex trading and other fun stuff, and hedging and risk management, and that was super fun for a while. And that experience was really like, it was kind of telling of like, hey, you know, you can work for somebody who's a nice person and who's going to treat you well and who will have meetings with you and who will like share his experiences and be good to me. And he was. And then I kind of outgrew being there once I had my CFA, and it was very clear that I was going to go on and do other things. So that was like the turning point for me in my career when I decided to either I need to like go get a portfolio management job or I was going to go do something else. And that's how Origin was born. So I don't know if that totally answers your question, but I think like, me now, I mean, like, I think the real advice to give people is, like, you got to be true to yourself.
Yes.
You have to fit in, for sure, in some regards, because, like, there's a tactful way to interact with people and to be a good part of a team and being a part of a community. And it helps to be a team player, for sure, and it helps to be a team player to the point of, you know, you pick up the slack for other members of your team, even if you don't necessarily get recognition for it, because you're moving the goalposts forward. And I didn't really understand that, and I kind of wish that I did, because that wasn't taught to me. What was taught to me was, like, you just have to assimilate with these people and just be like them. And probably because nobody really taught me really anything of what I was supposed to do. I was just kind of making this up as I go. But I wasn't really a team player. I could have been a better team player, for sure. I could have taken more ownership of my work. I could have, you know, done a lot more to move the goalpost forward for my whole team instead of just trying to like look like everybody else and be like everybody else. So I think there's like there's some authenticity to yourself, for sure, that needs to be held. And then there's the other part of it where if you're working in a group environment, you got to be part of the group. And it's just a balancing act.
I think it's really important that, again, any young person in this industry, no matter what, is now I wish I was told that earlier, to embrace my authenticity. What made me different, that I didn't have the traditional pedigree and to lean on that. It took me way too long. It took me a lot of bigoted, racist experiences at Merrill Lynch, and I'll say it, and it took a lot of, not only at Merrill Lynch, but all the way through, some horrible, hurtful experiences to realize that, well, here I am trying to fit in. And you're calling me names anyway. So if you're going to call me a name, I might as well be me. And call me a name now, I'm just going to be myself. And I think that that's when I realized that I'm going to tell my story. I'm going to be me. And more importantly, when I realized that, I'm like, you know what? It's for other people. You free other people to be like, you know what? I can be like Tyrone, And I realize now I've gone through all of those things. Like, I think as you said, it's like, well, all right. So you don't have to yell at me to get me to do stuff? Like, that's amazing. And what I learned was I would always say, well, if I was in a position like that, I'm not going to be that person. So you're grateful, for those people because you gave me the example of what not to be, of what not to do, how not to treat people. And pairing that with, because what people do in that is they stifle the true essence of what people are. To me, I think it's because they realize your potential. So they try and stomp on it so it don't come out, She probably realized you were way smarter than her. But so I think it's really powerful to hear that from you, from a woman in this industry where, again, you started right there in the pits of guys, toxic behavior, throwing stuff, breaking stuff, yelling at one another. So I can only imagine some of the stories you have. So thanks for sharing that as well. I think what we want to do here is, again, humanize the experience of the good and bad. Of what we all go through in this industry that, again, hasn't been kind, to people who are minorities, And I said this a minute ago, is where we literally are right at this moment was built by slaves, and they turned around and sold the slaves that built Wall Street as the first commodity ever sold on Wall Street. And that's not taught. Like, literally where we sit, the history of this business, the history of this actual location in New York City, and looking at ever since then, how it hasn't been kind to Black men, how it hasn't been kind to people of color, how it hasn't been kind to women. Black women especially. So I think we are at a time in this business where conversations like this, right?
Yeah.
We're on Wall Street, a Black man having a conversation with a white woman. It's so powerful. And so thank you for sharing that. And again,
sure.
I just think, again, the authenticity of being who you are and the power of these conversations goes well beyond whatever we think, right? It's gonna find its way to the person or the people who need to hear that. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's really neat. And with that, there's no better way, as you know, and I'll give you the origin of this question. So for me, I ask this question because it helps me heal. I'm in a process of healing because what I thought I was supposed to be in life, I'll never be. My dream is never gonna come true, unfortunately. And I'm still hurting from that, and I'm still trying to grow from it. So I asked this question because at one point in my life, and I hope I get there, I want to be able to answer this question with the same certainty and confidence that people have been answering and saying, I'm grateful that my dream never came true.
Yeah.
I'm not there yet. So that's the origin of this. That's the origin of this question. So with that, I'll ask you, what are you most grateful for that's never worked out for you?
I mean, you prepped me with this question before. So my reaction's not the same because I knew the question, but I had a long,
Right, yeah. As everyone does.
It's a good question. There are two moments for sure. But the most pivotal one, I think, well, I'll give you both of them, but I'll give you the one that really mattered more. And so I started working in the equity options pit in 2008. So
oh, wow.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
And actually, it was crazy good for my firm at the time because we were generally long options because more people, you know, people generally seek out a broker to sell options, not
yep.
to buy them. So
yeah.
Equity options traders, especially market makers, tend to be more long volatility than they are short. 2008, that was a great strategy. You were
yeah.
long vol blew out.
Yeah.
Made lots of money.
Cha-ching. Yeah.
The problem was that unwinding those positions then became really hard. And a lot of these options became illiquid. And some of these things you weren't actually able to unwind. So what happened was a very slow bleed from the VIX going to, I don't even remember, in the 80s or 90s,
right.
To, you know, just, you know, I think it like spiked up and then went back down. I don't remember the exact numbers. But then it just kind of, you know,
you're
like
right.
an LN curve going off,
leveling yeah.
off. And just every day you're bleeding money. So we started to feel that in middle of 2009. For sure. And it just went on. And then it was very clear to me in 2010 that I was not going to be the person that they were going to keep, you know?
Right.
Like, they had all these traders that had been around there a long time. I was kind of like this young girl, like, I don't know, they didn't know,
yeah.
you know, she has future doing something else, like, we're going to get let go of her. And they even had a conversation with me, like, that was like, hey, like, you know, maybe you want to go do something else. Like,
right.
we'll keep you around, and we'll give you a recommendation, but why don't you go find something else? And one of the guys I worked for put me in touch with this guy who was setting up a new equity options trading desk over at MF Global.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that this was the best. I was like, yes, I can't
yeah.
wait. This is great. We had a really good first interview. We had actually, it was super informal. He like took me out for pizza down on Stone Street.
Right.
We like ate pizza and we talked and it was great. And then he was like, yeah, you sound awesome. Like, can't wait to hire you. We had a second call about it and same thing. Everything's great. And then all of a sudden the call stopped coming. And I was like, Oh no, I thought I got my dream job. Like, I'm gonna
right.
be a trader for the rest of my life. It's gonna be the best. And he was like, you know, he just started ghosting me. And I was like, oh, okay. So I gotta go look for another job, right?
Right.
I'm like waiting for him to call and I look for another job and I get a job offer from Merrill Lynch working as basically a client associate
right.
for a large private wealth team. And the role was going to be more than like just an administrative client associate. It was going to be a lot of trading, a lot of analysis, like a lot of stuff that I thought would be really interesting. But like the big switch was going to be from being quote unquote buy side to sell side, which at the time was a big deal to me. And everything I heard from people who did that transition, they said that once you go to the sell side, you can never go back.
Right.
And I was like, that at the time, which now seems kind of insane, but at the time it was heart-wrenching for me to be like, this is my only job opportunity because this thing with MF Global is obviously not going anywhere. And so I called the guy a couple more times at MF Global to try to see if maybe he was going to offer me a job, and he still wasn't answering the phone anymore. So I was like, okay, I guess I just need to accept that, like, this is not what I'm going to get, and there
right.
really aren't any trader jobs out there right now because of, like, the economic environment. So I begrudgingly took this job at Merrill Lynch. Wow. That, you know, put me on the sell side and put me away from all the stuff that I was trying to go towards. And it actually took me a really long time to get where I am today, which I hope helps you.
Yeah.
Because I spent a lot of time on the sell side trying to get back to the buy side.
Right.
Okay, well, I'll go for my CFA, and then they'll want me, and then I'll do this, and they'll want me. And, like, I'll just, you know, I'll apply to all these places, and I'll try to get a job at a hedge fund. Like, I'll do anything I can. I'll talk to all these people. I talked to, like, I got on the phone with hedge fund managers, and I talked to other people, like, even sell side people who were managing these, like, separately managed account type portfolios to maybe get a job there. Like, I literally did everything I could to just, like, be the trader I thought I was supposed to be. And then I finally just accepted that that wasn't where I was going, and I opened my firm. But I still was kind of hanging on to it because I was like, okay, well, if I open my registered investment advisor, then I'll just be this portfolio manager for people, and I can create my own portfolio management firm, and it's going to be great, and I'm going to have this active portfolio, and everyone's going to come running because my returns are going to be awesome. That's not what happened.
Right.
Right? Like, what happened was is that the woman came to my office and asked for a profit-sharing plan, and I was blindsided because, like, people want real financial planning advice. They don't want this, like, crazy investment stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, my returns were substandard. Like, right. They were. I wasn't beating the market, therefore, I was not adding value, right?
Right.
And I had to learn that the hard way. And, yeah, so I think, like, looking back on it now, it all seems insane and stupid. Right. But it really is, like, I'm very grateful that it didn't work out for me at MF Global for a number of reasons. One, they went out of business a couple years later.
Let's talk about how that ended up.
That would have been, like, if they hired me on that desk, I would have been looking for a job, I think, a year later.
Exactly.
And also, like, the direction that my career went in is it's the way it was supposed to be.
Right.
And I really believe that. And I know that because that's how it was.
Right.
And sometimes that's hard for us to hear when, like, really hard things happen to us in life and we want to change it. But we can't because that's just what happened.
Right.
But it took me a long time to just really accept that, like, all of the things that led me to where I am today, no matter how painful they were or how hard they were, and I'm obviously leaving stuff out
along the way, of course.
That they were there for a reason.
Right.
And I don't mean it in, like, the concept of fate that, like, it's all laid out for me and I'm following a plan, which I know some people believe, but I don't necessarily believe that. But I do believe that I got where I'm supposed to be.
Right.
And I don't believe that this is the end for me.
Right.
Like, I also believe that there are going to be a lot of other decisions and a lot of other, like, pain and suffering that's probably going to happen to me.
Of course.
For sure going to happen to me.
It's life.
Along the way that I will be stronger for and I will get where I'm supposed to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
No, I say, but through that, right, those failures and that pain, this podcast was birthed, right? And again, thank you for sharing that. That's incredible. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for the time. This has been amazing. And I will end on this note. This conversation, again, has been enriching, has been empowering. But for anyone watching this, I want to end on this note. Like I mentioned the importance of where we sit. But for anybody watching this, 13 years ago, as a 26-year-old, I walked right past the New York Stock Exchange, completely unaware of where I was, completely unprepared for a job that I had just gotten. I was financially illiterate. And here I am about to take a job on Wall Street. And 13 years later, I am interviewing a financial advisor, a financial advisor podcast, right? As a financial advisor on Wall Street. I say all that to say that is the apotheosis of what this podcast is about. The possibility of being human, the possibility of being broken, and the truth of restoration. Thank you so much for tuning in. I appreciate you all. See you soon.
This was another episode of the Human Advisor Podcast. Visit humanadvisorpodcast.com for new episodes. And be sure to check out altruist.com to learn more about the first ever fully integrated digital brokerage platform for fiduciary financial advisors. No commissions, no fees, and no biases. The way it should be.